Session number 12935, Peter Thompson, Reel 2.
And we used to go ashore there for short leave, and we used to be allowed ashore till 9 o'clock. And the interesting thing was there that the pubs used to open at 9:30 because they didn't have enough beer to go round, so they used to save the beer for the local people. So consequently, they never used to open until we'd gone back on board. And then, as I say, we used to go back on board and just sit it out until early the 5th of June. We sailed out and got quite a way out and came back again because it had been cancelled. The weather was very rough at the time. And we came back into the Solent again and waited for 24 hours. And on the 6th of June, at around 2 o'clock in the morning, 11 o'clock at night, we sailed for France in convoy with about 5 or 6 LSTs in convoy with an ML as escort. And then we rendezvoused off the English coast, off the Portsmouth, and went across to France. And we arrived in off the coast of France around about 6:30 and waited and sat there until daylight. And then as daylight came up, there were just amazing scene. There were thousands of ships all around, and we crossed the English Channel, and really all you thought was you was in convoy with about 6 LSTs, which you left with at 11 o'clock. But when the daybreak broke, there were thousands of ships around. And then all of a sudden, at round about, just as we arrived there, 6:30, the Ramillies and the Nelson and everything else opened up with gunfire. All the other ships opened up with gunfire. And you could see the shells were coming across you. You can almost see the 16-inch shells from the Ramillies and that going over the top of you and making a terrible noise. And the shells were landing. You could see the shells landing in the distance. We lay about 2 miles offshore to begin with and waiting to go in. And the shells and then we saw all the smaller LCPs, LCVs, all going in for the initial assault. And then we opened our bow doors. We went in about for a mile offshore, opened the bow doors, and the 8 ducks went off first, and they went towards the shore. And then we had, as I say, about 10 or 12 tanks which had flotation buoys on the side and a propeller on the stern of them, and they went off the ship. And these tanks floated in on the water, and they went in towards land. And one or two of them, because the weather wasn't all that good then, it was still a little swell, and one or two of these tanks just went straight to the bottom. And then we unloaded the tank deck, and in the meantime, while we were waiting, we carried a Rhino or pontoon on the side of the ship and towed a Rhino at the stern of us. And this Rhino was supposed to take the other lorries and Bren carriers and that were on the upper deck. We brought them down on the hoist, and they were supposed to go on a Rhino, but the Rhino we lost in bad weather. And then round about 12 o'clock we set sail again, shut the bow doors, set sail again, and we went up on the beach at Courcelles around about 12 o'clock midday, and unloaded the rest of the tanks and equipment and everything else that we had on board. And then, as I say, we with an LST, it's different than an LCT, because when we were going up onto the beach, about 400 yards out, we used to drop our kedge anchor, a stern anchor. And this stern anchor used to trail behind it and dig itself into the sand or into the bottom. And we used to go up on the beach, and then the tide would go down, and we were left up on the beach for about 6 hours waiting for the tide to come back in. But in that 6 hours, we used to unload whatever we had on board. And also, on D-Day, we sat on the beach and we waited for the ambulances and the whatever transport there was to bring the wounded back from the front, which was just ahead of us, the front. And they brought 300 or 400 wounded men back straight on board us for us to bring back to England. It was quite a busy time. But even then, to me, as being a youngster, it was still an exciting time, more excitement than being afraid. You just felt that, you know, to see this scene all taking place in front of your eyes, it was amazing. It just took your breath away, you know.
Because of the immensity of it?
Because of the immensity of it and the firepower and everything, you know, it just happening, everything was happening there in front of you. And these men, we saw them, you know, sort of running up the beaches. When we were laying off the beach, we saw them running up the beaches and being shot down and that sort of thing, you know. And this possibly, you thought, oh God, I'm glad I'm not doing that, you know. But it was still sort of exciting. I mean, our ship was firing because there was planes coming over and that sort of thing. And the LST next to us, I don't know what number it was, but a Stuka came over and dropped a stick of bombs, and a bomb landed right where the bow doors and the ramp go down. It landed right in between the bow doors and blew one door, you know. And as I say, our guns were firing at the aircraft and that sort of thing. But it was all, you didn't have time to be afraid, really. And to see what was happening, it was sort of, you know, exciting more than afraid of being afraid.
Were you aware of bullets hitting the ship?
Not hitting the ship, no, near misses, but nothing touched us, no.
Which beach did you land at?
Well, we went into Gold Beach to start off with, which was Arromanch, but we pulled out of there because, as I said, our Rhino had got lost somewhere or it got destroyed. So we pulled up anchor and proceeded to call sails. But I think that was part of Juno Beach, where the Canadians landed, more than Gold Beach.
And do you know which unit you were carrying?
No, I can't remember that at all.
What was the mood of the soldiers as they went into the beaches in your ship?
Well, they weren't very happy at all. As I said, they were most of them were seasick anyway. And they weren't very happy at all, but they went in. They didn't have any qualms about it. They just went in didn't seem happy about it, but they didn't seem, you know, disgruntled. They just glad. I think they were just glad to get off at one stage. Whether they got a fight or, you know, be killed and that, they didn't seem to think about that. They just went. It's very difficult to, when you're all keyed up as well, it's very difficult to sort of get the feeling of, well, you get the feeling that everybody is keyed up as well, you know, and they're all, they must be afraid. I mean, there's not a man alive that wouldn't be afraid to think, what am I going into? We were probably luckier because we stayed on board and we didn't have to face that ordeal, what they faced. But the feeling must have been with them that, you know, are they going to make it and get to the top of those sand dunes and that.
Who seemed to have the predominance of firepower, the Allies or the Germans?
Well, the Allies. Yes, the Allies. I mean, the Germans were firing all sorts of things at us, you know, shells and machine guns and and that sort of thing. But with the absence of their aircraft, there were aircraft all the time flying over, but with the RAF and the Americans, they seemed to have supremacy of the air, and they kept them away quite a lot. They shot them down and kept them away from us quite a lot. It's quite a thing, that a noticeable thing that they did. There were a lack of aircraft which we expected, to be really shot up and bombed and everything else. It wasn't as bad as what we thought it was going to be. In some areas of the beaches, I believe that the men just walked in, and that was it. There was no opposition at all in minute spots, where they sort of couldn't see them or get to them or something.
Did you see any of the German obstacles in the sea?
Oh, yes. Yes, they'd taken most of them out where they were going to land, but they were still in areas that... Because to begin with, they just cut paths up the beach, and there was white tapes right along the beach, and you had to keep in that area all the time. And all the obstacles and that were taken away from there, blown up and that sort of thing. But in the areas that they hadn't had time to clear, there's still the obstacles in the beaches and on the sea, coming out of the sea at low tide sort of thing.
What did they look like?
Well, they just looked like girders, a tricular girder, like this, sticking out from the sea. And they tell me, because we didn't go in that early, there were mines and bombs or booby traps put on them, to blow up if you ever touched them. And a lot of the smaller boats did, the LCPs and LCVs and all the things like LCMs, a lot of them got destroyed. We saw them going up, by just touching them or going into them, or they'd go land right on top of them, as they went up the beach.
So they were like tripods?
Yes, yeah.
So, after you'd landed all your tanks and so on, you then pulled back to Britain?
After we loaded with wounded, yes. And during the voyage, the surgeons were very busy taking off legs and arms and all sorts of things, that men were maimed and that, and three or four soldiers died on board on the way back.
It must have been extremely grim on the way
back. Oh, well, it is a grim thing to see this, yeah. It's not very nice at all to see men... it wasn't on D-Day itself, but one of our crew members, he brought back his brother as a wounded man, wounded soldier. He'd been hit in the lower regions by a shrapnel from a mortar bomb, and he came back to him. And later on during the landings, I took my brother across on the same ship as I was on. It was about the 28th of June, I took him across on board my ship. He was in the Royal Army Service Corps as an electrician, and I landed him at Derrimance, Gold Beach, and he went on to fight at Calm.
So were the wounded that you carried back conscious or not?
Oh, some of them were conscious, but a lot of them were so badly wounded, you couldn't say they were conscious. I don't think they were very much with us at the time, they...
How many times did you go across, do you think?
Well, we went across 26 times, but it would have been a lot more than that. But we, in the end, we went to Ostend, and we were one of the first ships in there. And the Germans have sunk three ships across the mouth of the harbour at Ostend, and the Navy demolition squad had gone in and blown the middle one of the three out, and eventually they pulled all the debris out, and ships were able to get in there. And as I say, we were one of the first ships in. We went in and unloaded, And on the way out, we were bringing back the airborne men that had fought at Arnhem. And we had about 400 of them on board, bringing them back to England. And on the way out, the wind caught us, and we hit one of these wrecks, and it tore the bottom of the engine room out. And the engine room abandoned the engine room. They shut all the tight doors. And in the end, we had to get a tug to tow us out. And we lay off the coast for about 9 hours with no engines over the top of mine. We drifted out on top of the minefields outside the harbour. And we waited 9 hours for a tug to tow us back to England. And it took us back into Tilbury, eventually, into the dry dock at Tilbury. And that was the end of our Normandy SFA, because, as I say, we were in dry dock for about 6 weeks.
That must have been September 44, if it was about the time of Arnhem then.
Yeah, yeah.
Of all those many crossings of the Channel, which one sticks out in your mind the most? The actual D-Day? Or?
Well, yes, the actual D-Day. That, as I said earlier on, the only things that sort of spring to mind that happened after that was V-bombs, you know, and doodlebugs and things like that. We used to see them come over, and we were picking up from Tilbury and those places then, and the bombs were falling on Tilbury. And in fact, they hit two or three of the LSTs while they were in Tilbury.
You must have been puzzled as to what they were at first. Well,
we didn't know what they were, because we hadn't been ashore for months, and weren't, well, I suppose we knew because of the papers, but we didn't know what it entailed. You know, we knew that they came over and they made a terrible noise, and then the engine cut out, and they just dropped to the ground, you know, and blew up. But we never had any experience of that until we got to the Tilbury area.
Were there any other incidents that happened to you during your Channel crossings?
Not really, no. I mean, it just things such as some of the tanks and that at times weren't secured properly, and they would come adrift and start moving about in the ship. And which is a bit hairy, because once one starts, it starts knocking against the others, and it can cause a repercussion of each one sort of dislodging the other one, and then you're in trouble. You know? But we used to combat it pretty well. You know, they used to somehow stop it by lodging something in between, and so it's to stop in the movement. These ships are marvellous ships, because they rely entirely on tanks, ballast tanks, which take them up and down in the water. And when they're fully laden, you know, they're way down deep in the water for sailing across a sea. But when they get near a beach, they call what they ballast out. And as I say, they bring the bows, the draft on the bow would be about 4 foot six or 4 foot, 4 foot. On the stern at 10 foot, so that they could get up onto the beach. And whoever thought of, well, the English were supposed to have thought of them, and the idea went over to America, and they built them, and my ship was actually built in Boston Navy Yard.
How did you know that?
Well, I've researched it since. I've been to several places where they built LSTs in America, and next April I hope to go to Boston and see the shipyard where it was built there.
Did you stay on this LST to the end of the war?
No. When she went into dry dock in London, I was drafted off her and went back to barracks, and I got drafted back onto an LSD, a landing ship dock, which was a ship that carried other landing craft. LCTs, LCPs, LCIs, all sorts. And I went out far east with her and did invasions out there with her.
How did being on board an LSD compare with being aboard an LST?
Well, it had a lot more stability about it. Didn't have any, it was still a flat bottom boat because it had to go into areas that were shallow water. And as I say, we used to take other landing craft into invasions out there to Hong Kong and Chittagong and Rangoon and all around that area where the Japanese are captured, and we took it again. But that was a different type of ship in the fact that it didn't go on the beach at all. It just stayed off the beach and unloaded craft. Actually, the craft used to ballast down, let down the stern gate, and the craft used to come into the, they used to put the stern gate back up and then ballast out, and then you have a sort of dry dock. And they just used to lay dry until we got to where we were going. Then we would ballast down again, open the stern gate, and they'd go out on the under their own power, you know.
How did you like doing that kind of work in the Far East as compared with what you'd done on the LST?
Well, it's a very similar sort of situation, only that instead of lorries and that sort of thing, you would take another landing craft in. It was exactly the same situation, where it's hard work, very hard work. I've been on an amphibious craft since. I went on one, the HMS Fearless in Portsmouth, and they got girl sailors now, wrens, on board ships. And I said to this girl, no, I said to her, what are you then? So she said, I'm a seaman. I said, you can't be a seaman on a ship like this. On a destroyer or cruiser or anything like that, it's different. But on a landing craft, an amphibious ship, it's all hard work. It's killing. It's all rough. You know what I mean? There's no niceties about an amphibious craft at all.
So how could you manage it nowadays?
Well, I could manage. Well, as an ordinary seaman, I would be able to manage it. But how a woman can do it, I don't know, because I mean, it's too hard work for a woman, you know.
Maybe they've got it automated now.
No, exactly the same. It's all rust and dirt and grease and oil and everything like that, exactly the same as what it was then, and they expect these women to do it, and they do it. But she said the only thing is sometimes we have to turn around to another matlow and say, oh, just give us a hand to lift this up, you know, whereas a seaman would be expected to do it on his own, you know. But she said that's the only time we sort of get called out.
Any incidents that happened to you in the Far East that you can recount?
Just monsoons where we were going along and turning round without knowing it, sort of thing, because they were so bad and the seas were so rough. And
Typhoons,
yeah. But other than that, the same sort of thing, you know, we used to take ships, landing craft, and used to pick them up from, say, Aden and take them to somewhere in India or to Ceylon. Before the build-up to the invasions, you had to keep ferrying stuff, smaller stuff, across the ocean, you know, because they couldn't go on their own power because they were too small, and take them to the various places. And
did you get into any dangerous situations with enemy action in the Far East?
Well, no more than on D-Day. I mean, we were bombed, we were shelled, and that sort of thing, but nothing hit us, nothing. I was never a survivor or anything like that.
Where was it worst?
They're probably in Rangoon and Chittagong, around that area, was about the worst, where we met more resistance than anywhere else. And then we went back to Singapore, well, a place called Port Swetnam, to invade there at Port Dickson. And we carried an Indian regiment then on two LCIs that were going into land, and we were just pulling into there, and they said the war was over. They dropped the atom bombs, the war was over, and That was it. We laid off there for 2 or 3 weeks, seeing what was going to happen, then went back to Singapore. We unloaded the Indian soldiers, and they went in. And we went back to Singapore and went ashore there.